From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tony Kushner's HBO adaptation of his play Angels in America premiered Sunday to rave reviews. TV critic David Bianculli says it ranks among television's finest recent achievements. Set in the early stages of the AIDS epidemic, it follows the lives of straight and gay characters who are feeling abandoned by lovers, family, the Reagan administration, and perhaps God. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Kushner about writing Angels and about the experiences he drew on. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a box set of Nat Cole's classic singles, and linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the N-word, and why we often refer to it as the N-word. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. military officials say a suicide car bombing wounded at least 58 American soldiers and six Iraqis today at a U.S. base near the northern city of Mosul. They say the bomber drove a car loaded with explosives up to the gate of a U.S. barracks. The commander said soldiers guarding the gate opened fire on the driver when he attempted to charge the gate, causing the bomb to go off prematurely. Most of the injuries from the blast were reported to be minor. Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean campaigned in Iowa this afternoon with former Vice President Al Gore. Gore endorsed Dean this morning in New York City and called on Democrats to unite behind the former governor, NPR's Robert Smith reports.
Although Gore said the entire Democratic field was strong, the former vice president says only one candidate is able to inspire grassroots support across the country, Howard Dean. Gore specifically praised Dean's opposition to the war in Iraq, calling the situation there a quagmire and a catastrophic mistake.
He was the only major candidate who made the correct judgment about the Iraq war. And he had the insight and the courage to say and do the right thing.
At the rally in Harlem, local Democratic officials said that the Gore endorsement may help Howard Dean among African-American voters. Gore passed over his former running mate, Joe Lieberman, who is also vying for the Democratic nomination. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
The two owners of a Rhode Island nightclub and the road manager of a rock band have been indicted for manslaughter and the deaths of 100 people in a fire at the club last February. The fire was started by the band's pyrotechnic show. All three pleaded not guilty today to 200 counts each. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is trying to figure out how to get flu vaccines to the people who need them most. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
The CDC's flu vaccine recommendation calls for 185 million Americans to be vaccinated this season. But manufacturers made enough for only about 85 million people, because that's about how many doses they sold last year. With the early flu season this year, there have been spot shortages of vaccine. In a press conference today, CDC Chief Julie Gerberding said her agency is in the middle of measuring the shortage, and it may purchase remaining vaccine in the U.S. and Europe for distribution to hard-hit areas. She suggested that in areas where there are shortages, doctors consider vaccinating only the most vulnerable, and she emphasized that most people fully recover from the flu. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 41 points to close at 9,923 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 40 points to close at 1,908. This is NPR News. Officials in South Dakota are looking ahead to next year now that Congressman Bill Janklow has announced he'll resign. Bill Ellenbolt reports from South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Janklow was found guilty of second-degree manslaughter in the August 16th accident that killed a motorcyclist. The Republican congressman then announced he would resign as of January 20th. Governor Mike Rounds says for now, general duties and services will be coordinated among existing staff. Rounds adds while the state's interests will still be considered in Congress, the absence of a voice is unfortunate.
I wish we had the representation in Washington at this time. We don't. You play with the cards that are dealt. And in this case, we will be without a member of the House of Representatives in Washington until such time as the special election is complete.
A special election is scheduled with the state's primary on June 1st. The new representative would take office after the state's official canvass about a week later. For NPR News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt in Vermilion, South Dakota.
Former Senator Paul Simon has died after undergoing heart surgery. He was 75. Simon, a Democrat, was remembered on the Senate floor today by Senator Peter Fitzgerald, the Republican who currently represents Simon's home state of Illinois.
He was an extraordinary figure, extremely popular, and extremely well-respected, especially for his character and integrity.
Simon won a U.S. House seat in 1974 and defeated Republican Senator Charles Percy 10 years later. He tried for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1988, but quit after winning only the Illinois primary. Simon retired from the Senate in 1997. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Jewish World Service, providing humanitarian aid, disaster relief, and skilled volunteers to grassroots groups around the world. AJWS.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. HBO is now showing a 6-hour movie adaptation of the 2-part play Angels in America. My guest, Tony Kushner, wrote the play and the HBO adaptation. Part 1, which ran Sunday night, is set in New York in 1985, in the early stages of the AIDS epidemic. Frank Rich of the New York Times wrote, "Mr. Kushner's story is built on characters gay and straight alike who fight timeless battles over love and betrayal, even as they struggle with the meaning of faith, family, and America itself at an apocalyptic moment in the life of their nation." Al Pacino plays a character named Roy Cohn, based on the real Cohn, an attorney who worked with Senator Joseph McCarthy and was a conservative power broker. He was also a closeted homosexual who died of AIDS. In this scene, Cohn is reacting to the diagnosis he's just gotten from his doctor. He has AIDS. The doctor is played by James Cromwell.
This disease...
Syndrome.
Whatever. It afflicts mostly homosexuals and drug addicts.
Mostly. Hemophiliacs are also at risk.
Homosexuals and drug addicts. So why are you implying that I... What are you implying, Henry?
I don't think I was implying anything.
I'm not a drug addict.
Oh, come on, Roy.
What? Well, come on, Roy, what? You think I'm a junkie, Henry? Do you see tracks?
This is absurd.
So sad.
Say what?
Say Roy Cohn, you are a...
Roy.
You are a... Come on. Not Roy Cohn, you are a drug fiend. Roy Marcus Cohn, you are a... Go on, Henry, it starts with an H.
Oh, I'm not gonna get into...
With an H, Henry, and it isn't hemophiliac. Come on!
Why are you doing this, Roy?
No, I mean it, say it. Say, Roy Cohn, you are a homosexual. And I will proceed systematically to destroy your reputation and your practice and your career in the state of New York, Henry, which you know I can do.
Tony Kushner wrote Angels in America between 1988 and 1995. I asked him how the AIDS epidemic was affecting him when he started writing Angels.
It had affected me to a certain extent. I had lost a couple of friends, not close friends, however. But I'm not one of the people who lost, you know, dozens or even hundreds of people that they were close to or cared about. So I, when I first started writing the play, mostly I was frightened, as I think most gay men were at that point, because when I began work on the play, AZT was only beginning to emerge as a treatment protocol. Mostly I was in a place of a certain amount of despair because of the onset of the epidemic, the implications of it for the political project of lesbian and gay liberation. It was at the time that I started writing the play, thinking about writing the play, I should say, it was well into the third year of Reagan's second term in office, the world seemed to me to be heading towards some kind of armed confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States, or at least that seemed to be looming as a greater and greater possibility. Things were changing, of course, behind the scenes that I wasn't aware of when I first started working on the play, like the arrival of glasnost and perestroika in the Soviet Union. But that's, I guess, basically where I was when I was working on it.
One of the main characters in Angels in America, Lewis, leaves his lover after his lover starts really suffering the symptoms associated mm-hmm. with AIDS. And Lewis feels he's not good around illness, he's not good around sores and suffering, so he basically just walks out on his lover of over 4 years. So your criticism in Angels in America isn't just being leveled at the homophobes, it's being leveled at this main character who is gay, but doesn't have the strength to stay with his lover.
Right. I never really wanted the play to be an assault on homophobia because I find that kind of uninteresting. I mean, it's important to do it in newspaper columns. It's important to speak out about homophobia. It's important to protest when homophobia manifests itself, which it sometimes does in incredibly violent ways. But a play is ideally, I would think, a deeper and more complicated thing. And I never wanted to write a piece of agitprop. I find it really, really boring and even sort of panic-making when I find myself trapped in a theater and I realize that the thing that I'm going to be watching is yet another sort of statement that it's nice to be gay and it's bad to be mean to gay people, because I know that already and I've known that for a really long time. And I'm sort of bored by it as a topic.
Was the character of Lewis based on anyone who you knew? Had you watched people in that kind of situation leave a lover because they couldn't take it?
No, I mean, I do know now of a few people who walked out, mostly because I wrote the play and people started writing me letters. And occasionally people would say, "This happened to me. I'm a sick person and my lover walked out on me." No one's ever actually written to me and said, "I walked out on someone." But a couple of people with AIDS have written and said, "You know, it was very hard when this happened, and I'm glad you wrote about it." I sort of knew that it had to be happening. In the early days of the epidemic, almost immediately, there were plays and then films and books about gay men dealing with the health crisis. And mostly they reflected the reality, which is that gay men rose to the occasion and dealt heroically with the health crisis. But I also know that men are men. We're not necessarily raised to be especially brilliant as caretakers. And also, this was a time, the mid-80s, when the sort of concept of enlightened selfishness, of the sort of the self-serving individual as the engine of social progress, was being, you know, touted by the Reagan administration and a very, very successful political right. And I thought that was an interesting contrast, that people were being asked to sacrifice in unprecedented ways. Men were being asked to sacrifice in unprecedented ways to become nurses and caretakers for very sick people. At a time when everybody else was being told, the best thing you can do is to watch out for your own best interests and screw everybody else. Mostly, I only felt that it was probably necessary to create a character like Lewis because I wanted to say that it's very, very difficult to do what people were being asked to do when the crisis happened. It's hard to take care of sick people. And some people are going to have an impulse to run, and people do run. I mean, not so much with AIDS, but in other instances, I've certainly seen that happen.
My guest is Tony Kushner. He wrote the play Angels in America and the screen adaptation that's now showing on HBO. He also has a new musical that's playing in New York now called Caroline or Change. One of your characters in Angels in America is Roy Cohn, who worked with Senator Joe McCarthy during
McCarthy hearings.
During the McCarthy hearings and the red baiting era. What made you want to use Roy Cohn as a character? He's played by Al Pacino in the film. He was played by Ron Liebman on stage.
I felt that, when I was starting to work on the play, Roy had just died. He was a character that I had known since I was about 10 years old when I asked my father who Joe McCarthy had been, and my father gave me a history of the McCarthy era called The Nightmare Decade by Fred Cook. And I had sort of identified him early on as a kind of a villainous figure. I think I also probably figured out from things that were written about him, even when I was quite young, I knew I was gay, and I could sort of tell from the way that they were describing Roy and his relationship to G. David Shine, this blonde sort of Greek god that Roy, I think, was clearly in love with. And the Cohn-Shine relationship had a lot to do with the way that the Army-McCarthy hearings proceeded and with their ultimate, with the debacle that occasioned the end of McCarthy's political career. And I could tell from the way that it was being written that Roy was probably a gay man. He was also Jewish, which I think was an interesting combination to me, the fact that he was gay, that he was Jewish, and that he was right-wing. And really, in some ways, a kind of a gangster who was in love with the law and being a lawyer. And I found all those contradictions fascinating. When I was a young man in New York, he was a major power broker and kind of a remarkable figure. I mean, somebody with a lot of courage, if not the same ethical code that I have. And when he died of AIDS, the left responded in a rather, I mean, at least certain members of the old left who had hated him for decades responded with a degree of sort of viciousness and vindictiveness that made me actually feel sorry for him. And I think that's when the play began, really, was finding myself feeling bad for Roy Cohn and having to ask myself what on earth it meant to have these feelings about someone who, in many ways, I found really reprehensible. And I think that's why I was drawn to him and drawn to the idea of trying to dramatize him.
My guest is Tony Kushner. He wrote the play Angels in America and the new HBO adaptation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tony Kushner. He wrote the two-part play Angels in America and the new HBO adaptation. Here's a short scene from part two, which airs next Sunday on HBO. Prior Walter, who is dying of AIDS, has a vision, or a fever dream, in which he's visited by an angel, played by Emma Thompson. Walter is played by Justin Kirk.
I want you to go away. I am tired to death of being done to, walked out on, infected, f***ed over, and now tortured by some mixed-up, irresponsible angel. Some... Leave me alone!
You can't outrun your occupation, Jonah. Hiding from me one place, you will find me in another. I stopped down the road, waiting for you.
Angels in America isn't straight-up realism. You know, there's through fever hallucinations and Valium-induced hallucinations, there are a lot of sequences with, for instance, angels with historical figures from the past who visit the main characters, imaginary characters who come and visit. Why did you not want to do this as pure realism?
Well, I mean, of course, we're making an assumption by saying that it's not pure realism. I mean, there's a possibility, I suppose, that the magic that's represented in the play is real. You know, I mean, Peggy Noonan wrote that she believed that the dolphins that rescued Elian Gonzalez were actually angels from God, and that she was certain that Ronald Reagan would feel the same way. So, I mean, I think that realism is a kind of a complicated concept. I wrote the play in part out of my feeling as an agnostic that huge questions about God emerge whenever a crisis the size of the AIDS epidemic or, I think, the political crisis of Reaganism appear on the scene. One begins to ask questions about the benevolence or presence of any kind of consciousness in the universe. I asked those questions. I was thinking a lot about death. I was thinking a lot about my own mortality. I was thinking a lot about justice and whether or not the world would resume what seemed to me to be a seriously hampered progress towards something like social justice with someone like Reagan in the White House. And all of these questions are partly, to me, political, but partly theological. And I think that that immediately brought in ghosts and angels and theological stuff.
Why angels? What function do you see angels as serving in religion that made an angel the right vision for the character who's dying of AIDS to have?
Well, they're intermediaries. They're not gods, and they're not people. They're sort of the in-between. In the Holy Scriptures, the first angel appears after Abraham agrees to sacrifice his son Isaac, and the first angel appears to tell Abraham that God has changed his mind. And actually, I don't know if that's the first angel. It's I guess the first angel will probably be the one that tells Adam and Eve that they can't go back into the garden. I think that the angel that appears to Abraham is the first angel who sort of takes the place of God. After that angel appears, God doesn't speak directly to Abraham again. And as the Holy Scriptures progress, God speaks less and less to people. And they're intermediate, sort of amphibious beings. They're neither of the earth nor entirely of heaven. They're immensely powerful beings. There are things in angelological lore that I'm fascinated by, the fact that they're frequently... There's a lot of discussion about whether or not they have bodies and whether or not they have sexuality. In the Kabbalah, for instance, they are seen as having sex organs and even sort of a sexual energy, which I used in Angels in America. The other thing is that angels are the archangel... Gabriel, I guess, announces the end of the world. And the play is millennial in the sense that it refers to a tradition of apocalypse in which the ending is both an occasion of incredible terror and fear because it's the end of life as we know it, and also the moment of the greatest joy imaginable because it's about the end of history and the arrival of the kingdom of God. And I think that the image of the angel crashing through Pryor's bedroom ceiling, which was the first sort of the starting image of the play for me when I began writing it, has that kind of ambiguity.
I think it's difficult to write scenes where a character is visited by an angel because, you know, you really have to walk a line there because it can get hokey, it can get over the top, it could get strained. There's just like a lot of traps you can fall into when you're writing a scene with an angel in it.
Yeah. It's
can you talk a little bit about what line you wanted to walk? I mean, like...
I like to think I fell into every single one of them.
But can you talk about the things you felt you had to keep in mind when writing the scenes with the angel?
Well, I mean, I think when I wrote the play, I wanted to push myself as hard as I could push myself and to do things that I didn't know theater could actually do to make the people that would be producing the play, to make the theater that I was a part of work as hard as I could make it work. So it's very, very long and very complicated and very demanding and ghosts appearing and disappearing. And then this huge arrival. So just sort of technically, it's kind of a play meant to stagger the people who are producing it. When I decided to actually have the angel appear and speak, I thought, all right, well, I know I'm not going to succeed in doing this. I'm not William Blake. I've never spoken to an angel. I'm not a poet of sufficient genius to, you know, or of any genius, really. So I thought, this is going to be very, very interesting to see what happens when I reach the absolute limit of my abilities, which I know I'll reach when I'm writing this thing. It's an extremely strange encounter. But I also feel that the encounter works on some level, on some dramatic level. It's played rather brilliantly by Emma Thompson and Justin Kirk as a kind of insane love scene. And because of the things that you can do on film that you can't do on stage, I mean, Mike made it into this incredibly erotically charged encounter that, you know, essentially does what I wanted it to do, which was to feel to Pryor like both the beginning of a new life and the announcement of his the imminence of his demise, and something that frightens him so badly he gets up and starts running. I mean, I think it's an interesting scene.
The angel often starts a sentence with I.
Four eyes.
Oh, four eyes. What's that about?
The angel is a four. I mean, the angel is an aggregate entity. She's not just one being. She's many beings in one. And one of her manifestations is a collection of beings called, they're sort of from the Kabbalah, they're called the Daughters of Light. And there are four of them. They're fluor, phosphor, candle, and lumen. They each have a color assigned to them. And so when she speaks, she articulates for each of these four immensely powerful beings. Hmm. They all assemble into one being, the Continental Principality of America. When Pryor arrives in heaven, there are seven of these principalities. Each one is sort of the gathered energy of the entire sort of spirit matter and soul matter of all the people who live in each of the... I sound like a complete crazy person right now. But you asked. So, I mean, I worked out my own little sort of theology when I was working on the play, the Anti-Migratory Epistle, which is the name of the act. In which
was this fun to do as an agnostic, to write your own theology?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wrote an agnostic theology. I mean, the angels are in the same position I'm in and we're in. They don't know what happened to God. He's gotten... He's entered into this kind of very, very twisted and difficult relationship with human beings, which he created, and feeling both rejected by them and challenged and threatened by them and by their ideas and their progress, he increasingly disappears until finally goes away on long trips. And then finally, you know, in 1906, according to the angel, goes away and doesn't come back. And these sort of bureaucrats are left to run the ship of state, and they don't really know what they're doing. They don't really know how to make it work. And they see the world spinning into disaster, and the only solution they have is the, you know, classic reactionary solution, which is make everything stop.
Tony Kushner will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
G is great after being out late.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new 4-CD set of Nat Cole's classic singles. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers why certain words are taboo. And we continue our conversation with Tony Kushner about Angels in America.
We go long harmonizing a song, or I'm reciting a poem. Hours go by and they give me the eye, walking my baby back home. We stop for a while, she gives me a smile, and snuggles her head on my chest. We starting to pet, and that's when I get her talcum all over my vest. After I kinda straighten my tie, she has to borrow my comb. One kiss, then I continue again, walking my baby back home.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tony Kushner. He wrote the two-part play Angels in America and the new HBO adaptation. The second part will be shown on Sunday. Kushner also has a new musical called Caroline or Change at the Public Theater in New York. Here's a scene from the very beginning of Angels in America. Two lovers, Pryor, who has AIDS, and Lewis, have just come from the funeral of Lewis's grandmother. Lewis is played by Ben Schenkman.
She was pretty crazy. She was up there in that home for 10 years talking to herself. I never visited. She looked too much like my mother.
Mm. Poor Lewis. I'm sorry your grandma's dead.
Tiny little coffin, huh? Mm. I'm sorry I didn't introduce you. I always get so closety at these family things.
Butch. You get Butch. Hey, Cousin Doris, you don't remember me. I'm Lou, Rachel's boy. Lou, not Lewis, because if you say Lewis, they'll hear the sibilant S.
I don't have a sibilant S.
I don't blame you. Hiding. Bloodlines. Jewish curses are the worst. I personally would dissolve if anyone ever looked me in the eye and said fa. Fortunately, wasps don't say fa. And by the way, darling, Cousin Doris is a dyke.
No. Really?
You don't notice anything. If I hadn't spent the last 4 years filleting you, I'd swear you were straight.
One of the characters in Angels in America, Lewis, this is the character who flees from his lover when his lover is dying of AIDS. Lewis is Jewish. His grandparents emigrated to the United States from Eastern Europe, but he's disconnected from his family. He's disconnected from his religion. You've described yourself as an agnostic. Did the actual religion ever figure into your life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm agnostic, but I'm completely 100% Jewish. I think that there's a certain aspect of Judaism that has room in it for a kind of tortured agnosticism. Most religions, in fact, acknowledge the elusiveness of God, and there is in every religion room for people who are tortured by doubt because they've never been directly approached by the Almighty. But Judaism is enormously important to me, and being Jewish has always been incredibly important to me. As I've said many times, being Jewish is how I learned how to be gay, because it was a way of understanding what it meant to have an identity that a lot of people hated, but that you yourself knew to be an important source of being, and to learn not to apologize for being something, even if the majority of people surrounding you felt that this thing that you were was wrong or evil. And I grew up in a small southern town with a certain amount of anti-Semitism in evidence, and I was taught by my parents never to apologize and never to hide the fact of who I was. And so when I had to face up to being gay and come out of the closet, that was my model.
Was there much of a Jewish community in Lake Charles, Louisiana, where you grew up?
Yeah, there's about 100 Jewish families and a small and very beautiful temple, Temple Sinai. And, you know, we certainly had non-Jewish friends, a lot of non-Jewish friends, but we were very deeply connected to this community that I think had a certain kind of closeness because we were in the Deep South, and, you know, it was very different than growing up on the Upper West Side.
Which is where I always assumed you were from. I just assumed you grew up in Manhattan.
No, I was born in Manhattan, but when I was 2 years old, my father and mother moved to Lake Charles, Louisiana.
What brought them there?
My father grew up there, and my father's father had a small lumber business, and my father is a clarinetist, my mother was a bassoonist, and they became nervous about raising a family on a musician's income, so they moved down to Lake Charles. And, you know, it was the 50s, and my mother was sort of told not to tour and that she needed to be home for her children, and she was also a confirmed Freudian and listened too much to psychoanalysts who told her that it would be a big problem. This is back in the blame mommy for everything period of American psychoanalysis, and so they went down to Lake Charles for economic reasons.
Since we've established that I was not the only person who assumed you grew up in Manhattan, what was it like for you to actually move to Manhattan and find there a much larger Jewish and a much larger gay community than you ever could have, found in the part of Louisiana where you grew up?
I mean, I was both delighted to find a larger Jewish community, I mean, a much larger Jewish community. I've always had family in New York, so New York has never been a strange place to me, but it was both sort of fun to be surrounded by so many Jews when I got up here, and also a little, I think, sad. I had liked the uniqueness that being Jewish gave me in Louisiana, and I lost that a little bit. I mean, I was another Jewish kid at Columbia, and it was hard to surrender that uniqueness. I sort of substituted it by being a Southerner. I saw the first time I ever saw two men kiss was when I was a freshman at Columbia, and it completely freaked me out.
Why?
I knew I was gay. Oh, I was just horrified. I mean, I wanted something like that so badly, and it was shocking to me that two guys would do it. It was two students at a rehearsal for a play at Columbia, and I was completely shocked that people would do that in public. And I think I had to be very, very angry at it to keep it away from myself so that I wouldn't feel any temptation to give in. And I didn't give in. I mean, the first time I got together with a guy was when I was almost graduated. I had, 1 week left at Columbia. And it still took another 3 years before I began to come out of the closet. This is a very, very, very big step and a very difficult one.
One of the characters in Angels in America is a Mormon, and he's married, although he knows he's gay. He's never been able to really admit it, even to himself. Did you have a girlfriend like he did? Did you ever have a girlfriend from whom you hid your real sexual identity from?
Sure, in high school I did. And when I... And then she came to visit me a couple of times she came up from Louisiana to visit me a couple of times in college. And I told her when I was in college that I was gay and that I didn't want to have sex. And she cried a lot. And that had a big impact. I've never forgotten that. And I realized at that point, and decided to remember it, that being in the closet and homophobia doesn't just have as its victims gay men and lesbians. It also has as its victims the people that we're, in a sense, forced to lie to. And that lie is costly it is more costly to the people who have to deny their own sexuality, but it's certainly no picnic to find out that the person you're married to would, you know, rather be sleeping with someone of their own sex.
And you have a very sympathetic portrayal of the woman who's married to
Harper,
the gay
yeah.
man. Yeah. Well, Tony, I wanted to talk with you also about your new play, a musical or opera, whichever word you prefer, it's sung through, called Caroline or Change. But I regret we're not going to have time to do that today. So I'm hoping at some other time we can do that.
Yeah, I'd love to.
And I have one more question for you. Have you been watching Angels in America on television?
I watched the beginning of it last night, and then I got freaked out, and I watched the end of it.
Why were you freaked out?
I sort of went off and read a book in the middle part. I mean, I've seen it many, many times. I can't comprehend. I don't have any referent. I'm a playwright, and I have no referent to the notion that thousands or millions of people were all watching this thing that I wrote at the same time. It's overwhelming and strange. And I found it, I mean, I'd seen it in big movie theaters with a lot of people watching, but that felt in a way like a play. The fact that I turned on my television set and there it was, and there were those people that I made up saying those words is kind of hard. And, you know, I thought, I don't know that I want to, like, get too comfortable with this. So I ran. But then I had to come back and watch her crash through the the ceiling. I thought that was a kind of an important. I wanted to make sure that it still happened.
The angel crashing through the ceiling.
Yeah.
It happened.
Yes, it's just like I remembered it. So.
Well, Tony Kushner, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
And a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Tony Kushner wrote the play Angels in America and the new HBO adaptation. Part 2 will be shown on Sunday. Kushner has a new musical called Caroline or Change that is now at the Public Theater in New York. He also co-edited the new book, Wrestling with Zion. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new 4-CD set of Nat Cole's classic singles. This is Fresh Air. Nat King Cole started his career as a jazz pianist with a Jumpin' Little Trio and ended it as a singer of sentimental ballads and novelty tunes performing with studio orchestras. Critic Kevin Whitehead says jazz fans who lament the loss of the pianist may overlook the power of the singer. A new set of Cole singles is out. Kevin provides a breakneck tour.
I took you to a nightclub and bought you pink champagne. You rode home in a taxi, and I caught the subway train. That ain't right. Baby, that ain't right at all. Taking all my money, going out having yourself a ball.
24-year-old Nat King Cole, sounding a bit green on his first R&B hit, cut in 1941 with his working trio. While Cole, the singer, eventually displaced the buoyant trio pianist, he balanced both roles through the 1940s with jazz hits like Straighten Up and Fly Right and Sweet Lorraine. But even with the trio, he'd reach out to new audiences. In 1947, they cut this Fish Out of Water country tune.
A boy from Texas, a girl from Tennessee. He was so lonely in New York, and so was she. The boy said howdy, the girl said, "Hi, you are." He could have kissed her when he heard that southern drawl.
That's from Capitol's new 4-CD set, Nat King Cole, the classic singles, about a quarter of which is devoted to the trio in the 1940s. The singer hit his stride in the early 50s with Mona Lisa, Too Young, and Unforgettable. That warm, responsive, attentive voice was in full bloom by 1954 when he recorded A Blossom Fell. It was arranged by Nelson Riddle, a frequent collaborator whose orchestrations fit him like a velvet glove.
A blossom fell from off a tree. It settled softly on the lips you turned to me. The gypsies say, and I know why, a falling blossom only touches lips that lie. A blossom fell, and very soon I saw you kissing someone new. Beneath the moon, I thought you loved me. You said you loved me. We planned together to dream forever. The dream has ended, for true love died the night a blossom fell and touched two lips that lied.
That's not jazz, But Nat Cole always paid a jazz musician's attention to phrasing and shading. And even in the mid-50s, when he was a pop phenom, the first African-American to host a TV variety show, he'd do a few swingers, like Ballerina, an oddly heartless portrait of a dancer who put career before romance.
Whirl, ballerina, whirl. And just ignore the chair that's empty in the second row. This is your moment, girl. Although he's not out there applauding as you steal the show. Once you said his love must wait its turn, you wanted fame instead. I guess that's your concern. We live and learn, and love is gone, ballerina gone.
As the 60s dawned, Nat did a bit called Mr. Cole Won't Rock and Roll in his stage act. In fact, he'd courted the youth market from the mid-50s, fronting a few doo-wop groups and vaguely rocking rhythm sections. Richard Wess's arrangement of a 1961 single clones recent hits by Benny King and the Drifters.
Oh, when you're alone, you're afraid that is true. Love won't come, it won't happen to you. So to let this chance for happiness go by, it would be a sin. Don't be afraid, let true love begin. I know the feeling.
Quality slipped in the 60s. Ramblin' Rose was nice, but the banjo strumming Those Lazy, Hazy, Crazy Days of Summer and L-O-V-E with its Dixieland ending really sounded like sellouts. Capitol, meanwhile, had been expanding Cole's market across borders as well as genres. He cut songs in phonetic French and Japanese and made several albums in Spanish, which he sang with a credible American accent.
Estás perdiendo el tiempo, pensando, pensando. Por lo que más tú quieras, hasta cuando, hasta cuando. Y así pasan los días, y yo desesperado, y tú contestando, quizás, quizás, quizás.
In 1965, Nat King Cole died of lung cancer at age 47. The only singer half so suave nowadays is his brother Freddie Cole. There are over 100 songs in the Nat Cole singles box. Naturally, there are some duds and songs that blatantly imitate earlier hits, but Cole treated any material with peerless musicality and taste. Like Fats Waller or Billie Holiday or Dinah Washington, Cole could sing anything and was often asked to do so.
Love, no Cole, toba, love. Wafutarino takara. Aishi aiba ashitamo akarui. Love, love you, love, I love you. Love, love you, love, I love you. Love, love you, love, I love you.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. He reviewed Nat King Cole, the classic singles. Coming up, Taboo Words. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Every age has its dirty words. They usually involve sexual and scatological meanings, but now they're as apt to involve race, ethnicity, or sexual preference. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts on the changing notion of taboo.
It was a sort of story about political correctness that the media loved to report. A white employee at the University of Virginia Medical Center was talking with some co-workers about the names of football teams, and he remarked that having a team called the Redskins was as derogatory to Indians as having a team called niggers would be to blacks. His use of nigger was enough to provoke some of the staff to organize a protest. The university president called the employee's remark unfortunate and offensive. And Julian Bond, who's now a history professor at the University of Virginia, demanded that the employee apologize and that he be required to take sensitivity training. It's hard to find any word to describe that reaction short of obtuse. After all, the employee had only mentioned the word nigger as an example of an unacceptable racial epithet. But there was also something disingenuous about the way critics ridiculed the episode as another example of political correctness run amok, as if it revealed the fatuousness of all our concern about offending ethnic sensibilities. The fact is that nowadays, a word like nigger has acquired a kind of incantatory power that even the most benign intentions can't entirely bleach away. I was struck by that one day last spring when I was talking to an undergraduate linguistics class about the origins and use of racial epithets. That's clearly as neutral and clinical a context as anybody could imagine. But when I pronounced the word nigger, one black student raised his eyebrows. "You're sure you're not getting any secret satisfaction out of being able to say that word?" I told him, maybe a little defensively, that I was just mentioning the word, not using it. But I had felt a complicated twinge when I said it. I recalled making an effort to say it as offhandedly as possible, without betraying my unease with a telltale pause or change in pitch. It was the same feeling that I have when I have to mention a four-letter word in the course of making some recondite point about English syllable structure. I know that linguists have a dispensation to say those words, but it doesn't entirely dispel the sense of transgression. That's what it means to say that a word like nigger is taboo. Whatever the context, the very syllables have become an incantation that evokes all the ugly violence of racial hatred in exactly the same way that dirty words are contaminated by the things they refer to, a taint that bleeds through any quotation marks you put around them. Of course, for us, taboo is a secular and ironic word. When we talk about taboo subjects or taboo words, it's usually to make light of other people's uptight squeamishness. But in the Melanesian and Polynesian cultures that we originally borrowed the word from, it signified what Sir James Frazer described in The Golden Bough as contagious magic. If a dead body was taboo, then so was the man whose shadow fell on it, and the utensils he touched, and the meals he prepared with him, and so was his name. Each of them became dangerous to other people and to itself. And that's exactly the sense of taboo that attaches to what we call dirty words, the sense that a name can be contaminated by the thing it's connected to. It's no different from the magical beliefs of the Polynesians, except that when we do it, we don't describe it as superstition. Taboos are always a guide to the deepest fears and inhibitions of a culture. We've forgotten the sacral power that a reference to God's wounds or God's blood could conjure up in Shakespeare's time. And we find it amusing to imagine the horror that Henry James would have felt if he could have seen an episode of The Sopranos. But then James would be puzzled at our age's almost physical aversion to ethnic epithets, to the point where some people are uncomfortable when they have to read Huckleberry Finn or a Flannery O'Connor short story. Not that James was the sort of person who would have used nigger in his own speech, but he would have avoided it because it was vulgar, not because it was obscene. The shift is implicit in the way people talk about the N-word nowadays. That's the same coy formula that parents have always adopted so they could upbraid their children for using forbidden language without actually having to pronounce the words themselves. And that may have been part of what was behind that recent story about the Louisiana second grader who was sent home for using a bad word when he told a classmate that his mother was gay. If those reports are true, of course, the teacher was even more stupefyingly clueless than the people who got worked up over the remark made by that unfortunate University of Virginia employee. To believe that gay is a bad word isn't just misinformed. It implies that homosexuality might be so abhorrent that its very name could be impure, so that it becomes something literally unspeakable. But as demented as that misapprehension is, I suspect it wouldn't have occurred to that teacher 30 years ago, before the notion of magical taboo was extended to words like these. That's the trouble with sacralizing these epithets. It risks turning attitudes like racism and homophobia into guilty pleasures. Taboos always confirm the dark power of the ideas they suppress. Describing nigger as the N-word doesn't just mark it as something we're not supposed to say in public. It also ensures that it will have an intriguingly transgressive force when we say it in private. Not that anyone should ever mention the word for any reason without a sense of its power, but it doesn't deserve the awe that a taboo implies. Let it lie in the sun to rot.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information, and he's the author of The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The New Rabbi, a book about the search for faith, leadership, and community by Stephen Fried, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg is the former president of the American Jewish Congress, and he helped to found Peace Now in Israel. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his new book, The Fate of Zionism, A Secular Future for Israel and Palestine. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.